This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A decline in the population of monarch butterflies is concerning scientists. A letter bringing attention to the loss of the butterflies was signed by scientists from around the world. That was delivered to the Secretary of the Environment in Mexico City and to the Canadian and U.S. embassies before the leaders of all three nations met for a summit in Mexico. Among those who signed that letter is Stephen Malcolm, a professor of biological sciences at Western Michigan University. Stephen Malcolm, thank you very much for being here.
Very welcome.
What is the current state of the monarch butterfly?
I think it can only be described as catastrophic that this winter the overwintering population area has been reduced to 0.67 hectares. And when measurements started being made in about 1994, In 1996, I think it was, the population was at 21 hectares in Mexico. So this is a migratory butterfly that flies to Mexico, and the entire eastern North American population coalesces into, formerly there were 12 locations, now there are 17 known locations. So this last winter, only seven of those 17 locations had butterflies, and the population, as I said, had gone from a high of about 22 hectares about 26 years ago, to 0.67 hectares.
So there's been a decline for a while, but then we just saw a really steep drop more recently.
The last 2 years have been really disastrous. Last year it was 1.2 hectares. This year it's almost halved to 0.67. Do you want me to talk about the reasons for that?
Yes, please.
So I hate to use the analogy of the perfect storm, but it does seem to be apt in this particular case. So we have a combination of factors. And the biological factors that are exacerbated by environmental issues were compounded 2 years ago by an enormous drought, an extremely early spring. So in comparison to this winter that we have now, 2 years ago we had a wonderfully balmy, blissful, warm winter.
Wearing shorts in March, as
absolutely,
I recall.
Absolutely, yes. And there was a monarch butterfly was seen in Toronto in April, which was absolutely extraordinary. And so they got too far north too quickly that spring. And we were seeing monarchs here in Michigan in early May, perhaps even at the end of April. And they did okay in the Great Lakes region, but in the main breeding areas of Oklahoma and southern Nebraska and Kansas, there was an enormous drought and the milkweeds all died and the population crashed really seriously, which meant that subsequent colonists to the Great Lakes were impacted by that drought. And so the numbers that went back to Mexico were considered to be very, very low. And so that winter, it went down to 1.2 hectares. And then we think the consequences of that added to the environmental issues that this letter was really addressing has really caused a serious problem.
So the response at this summit in Mexico was that the three countries, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, have agreed to appoint a task force to look into the declining population of monarch butterflies. Do you find that encouraging?
Yes, I do. I think it was very good that this letter was sufficiently articulate in the sense that science always has this problem of communicating to politicians. And they're often very deaf to the communications that scientists make and are more attuned to the communications that come from lobbyists and financial interests, economic interests. So it's encouraging that they heard the plea from scientists. But this plea didn't come just from scientists. It also came from the group of 100 led by Homero Arichis in Mexico. And this is a group of artists, poets, musicians from around the world. So you had a lot of people from Mexico, the USA, and Canada signing onto this letter, but also international people who are concerned about these issues, including a couple of Nobel Prize winners.
But doesn't the intellectual heft of scientists bring a little more credibility to something like this?
Yes, I think so, as a scientist. my colleague Lincoln Brower and his colleague Ernest Williams wrote the letter. And it was communicated by Homero and Gary Nerban from the University of Arizona. This letter was particularly resonated with me because Lincoln Brower is so passionate about the decline of the monarch butterfly. So he's retired now, but his whole career has been working with monarch butterflies. And he's, if you pardon the pun, he's sort of spawned a whole multiple cohorts of scientists who have worked with him over his very long career, who have become passionate about the butterfly, and that includes me. But many of these people, like Karen Oberhauser in Minnesota and Chip Taylor in Kansas, have set up wonderful organizations that are monitoring the status of the monarch population. And this has led to an absolutely fantastic citizen science initiative throughout the country, where you have people from the ages of 4 to 94 are working on monarch butterflies and sending information that is collated and posted on the web. And so you can look at the status of the migration, you can look at the success of larval breeding on feeding on milkweeds. And many, many citizen scientists are passionate about the butterflies and grow native milkweeds to raise the butterflies. So there's an enormous groundswell of interest, but despite all that interest, the butterfly is suffering.
Do you have a thought or two, and maybe do other scientists have a thought or two, on what could actually be done that would help reverse that decline of population?
Well, the two biggest factors that are identified in this letter that are responsible for the declines, apart from weather-related factors and global climate change, are agricultural policy in the USA and Canada that relates to, at the moment, the agricultural policy is very much favoring biofuel production and the growth of corn for biofuels. And this means that the price of corn has gone up, and the subsidies make it a very attractive proposition for farmers. And so this letter identifies the enormous increase in the acreage of corn being planted in the USA and Canada, and the impact that that corn is having on the environment, because a large proportion of that corn is genetically modified to express herbicide resistance or insecticidal resistance. And they particularly identify the herbicide-resistant crops because farmers are buying these seeds from companies like Monsanto. They really like the technology. They grow the seeds, and they do very well. When they germinate, they then spray everywhere with herbicide, things like Roundup, and this kills so-called weeds. And milkweeds
are among the weeds that get hit.
So despite the fact that this practice is selecting for resistant plant varieties that become superweeds that don't respond to the herbicides, herbicides are still being sprayed on a very wide acreage across the USA and Canada. Then in addition to this, there are other GM crops that have been considered for quite a long time that are expressing insecticidal genes that we think, the scientists who work with monarchs, think there is still a problem associated with those. So the monarchs are encountering at least two GM technologies, particularly focused with corn and soybeans, and the very large acreage that is planted to those crops, particularly in monarch breeding areas. Then further south, you've also got other crops that are also herbicide-resistant, like cotton, and then you have sweet corn in Florida and places like that. So the monarchs are flying through an environment that's absolutely saturated with various kinds of pesticides, whether they're herbicides or targeting insects. A colleague of mine, Meron Zalutsky in Australia, wrote a paper recently where he was talking about the matrix that the butterflies fly across. And this matrix is homogeneous. It's clean. It's clean as a whistle. All that's there is soybean and corn right up to the edges of the roads. And I don't know if you've ever been to Nebraska and Iowa in the spring. It's like a chocolate brown desert. Mm. And so you see these enormous bulldozers and machines terracing the land, and it goes right up to the tarmac on the edge of the road. There's no edge at all. And this is what's happening with the herbicides that have been broadcast in over much wider areas than Nebraska and Iowa. And this makes for an agricultural desert for monarchs, and it's very difficult for them to find milkweeds. And this letter calls for efforts to reduce that negative impact, the homogeneity of that matrix. We really like heterogeneous environments, you know, and then there are lots and lots of scientists and agricultural entomologists who are really concerned about the decline of pollinators. And so other butterfly species and wasps and bees, and then also the decline of natural enemies, the predators and the parasites that can attack the pests on crops. So all those natural ecosystem services are being lost through this somewhat naive, widespread use of technologies that benefit just one part of the North American economy. That's including Mexico, the USA, and Canada.
Can something be done that addresses the problem with the monarch butterflies, but can be done in a way that is relatively cost-effective? Or based on what some of what you're saying there, is this going to require a very broad change in American agricultural practices? Is that the only way to achieve that reverse in the monarch butterfly population?
The letter's calling for two fairly simple remedial measures that could be reviewed. The first is to include more diverse roadsides. And they talk about the length of the roads in North America and the value that they can provide for wildlife.
In other words, planting milkweed.
They could be planting milkweed, or they could be just leaving them to be weedy. And also making sure that they're mowed at times that don't impact the biodiversity. So if you wait until October to mow them, then that won't impact all the insect species, including monarchs, that could be using the food plants in those roadsides. So, for instance, here in Kalamazoo, US 131 has some nice wildflower plantings, but it's quite often mowed during the summer. And if we could encourage the Road Commission to mow at biologically more relevant times rather than times that suit the tidiness of the roads, if you like, then that would be an enormous benefit given the extent of roads in North America. But it would be also good to see farmers' fields having borders that include weeds that can provide some of these ecosystem services. And then we also have a problem with weak implementation of regulations for the use of GM crops. For instance, I had a postdoc working in my lab who was going around and measuring whether the corn plants around here were expressing BT genes. BT is a toxin that comes from a bacterium that's been inserted into many, many crops around the world that expresses an insecticide that kills, in the case of corn, the European corn borer. So he went around corn crops around Kalamazoo and measured the expression of this gene and found that they all express the gene, and only 80% of it is supposed to express the gene, and there's supposed to be a 20% border around the crop. And this is designed to reduce the evolution of resistance to the technology in the target organisms, in this case insects. And so if farmers didn't do that, if they did what they were supposed to do, then this would increase the diversity, and this would be true for herbicide-resistant crops as well. And so this is why we already have the evolution of superweeds. And so it means that the farmers and Monsanto get locked into an arms race where they're constantly developing new technologies, and the natural species, the weedy things, and all those insects don't stand a chance of keeping pace with those changing technologies. So overall, it requires a change of policy and a recognition that sometimes subsidies, in the case of corn, for biofuels, don't make a lot of economic sense. A lot of environmentalists feel that the amount of nitrogen that has to be put on corn make it economically unfeasible. And so why are we doing this? And then we have all these additional costs on top of the fossil fuel costs of those technologies.
Beyond basic human decency, or basic decency to all living things, I guess maybe we should say in this case, Why should we be concerned about the declining population of the monarch butterfly? Are there things beyond just the fact that we wouldn't have monarch butterflies that should have us worried about this?
Well, I think the most compelling factor is that the monarch butterfly is a wonderful indicator of environmental change, of environmental problems, perturbations. Lincoln Brower calls them the canary in the cornfield. And the fact that they are moving over the three countries of NAFTA, the three countries of North America, and these three countries have very big economies, and trade is very important to those three countries. The monarch butterfly is a wonderful indicator, and this is why the Commission for Environmental Cooperation in Montreal, which is the environmental component of NAFTA, embraced the monarch butterfly as their symbol. And so it acts as a symbol of environmental perturbations. And these dramatic changes across North America, not just east of the Rocky Mountains and what's happening in Mexico, but the same thing's happening in California. The monarch butterflies are collapsing there too, for similar reasons. But that hasn't received the attention that the eastern population has because it's so much smaller. But the same things are happening there, and we need to address the viability of our agroecosystems and to work out the importance and significance of the ecosystem services that are provided to agriculture and our economy and our overall biodiversity. So it isn't just ethics, it's economics and a whole suite of concerns, and the monarch butterfly really is a very effective indicator of those impacts.
It tells us something perhaps about the air we're breathing, something about the food we're eating as well?
Yes, you can actually. Monarchs are surprisingly informative. If you catch a monarch, there's a lot can be told from a monarch's body. There's a group in Guelph in Canada who are looking at isotope ratios in the butterflies. We've looked at the fingerprints that come from steroids that are sequestered by the butterflies from their milkweed host plants. You can look at the fat that they build up when they're feeding on nectar. And you can look at isotopic ratios in the nectar that they're feeding on and look at the way in which nectaring plants, particularly in the late summer and autumn, are impacted by agricultural practices as well. That in turn impacts all the other butterflies and the hoverflies that eat aphids and the parasites and the bees and the wasps and things like this. You know, it sounds a bit like I'm a nerdy aging hippie environmentalist, but these are really important services that are provided by ecosystems, and we're increasingly understanding the value of these services. So these are important issues. They aren't just pretty butterflies. This is serious. This is real. These are real impacts, and this is a great indicator species.
How much time do you think we have left to do something about the monarch butterfly?
Well, Lincoln and I wrote a paper 23 years ago where we designated phenomena like migration at the risk of endangerment. So we said the monarch butterfly was a wonderful example of a migration that represents an endangered phenomenon. And so we think that paper has been fairly prophetic, and there is a very real risk that the migration of monarch butterflies east of the Rocky Mountains will collapse, and we will not see migratory monarchs in Michigan. This doesn't mean the butterfly will go extinct. It certainly won't. But that migratory phenomenon, which is so beloved by so many people east of the Rocky Mountains, will disappear. We think there's a very real possibility of that.
Stephen Malcolm, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Stephen Malcolm is a professor of biological sciences at Western Michigan University. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.